I'm here in Gravesend on the south bank of the Thames estuary, just as the sun's going down. I've come here because this is where Joseph Conrad began Heart of Darkness, one of his most famous fictional works. And standing here looking across the implacable expanse of water, surrounded on all sides by the flat estuary landscape, there's a strong sense of the melancholy and foreboding captured in the novella's opening paragraphs.
The Nelly, a cruising yawl, swung to her anchor without a flutter of the sails and was at rest. The flood had made, the wind was nearly calm, and being bound down the river, the only thing for it was to come to and wait for the turn of the tide. The sea reach of the Thames stretched before us like the beginning of an interminable waterway. In the offing, the sea and the sky were welded together without a joint, and in the luminous space, the tanned sails of the barges drifting up with the tide seemed to stand still in red clusters of canvas sharply peaked with gleams of varnished sprits. A haze rested on the low shores that ran out to sea in vanishing flatness. The air was dark above Gravesend, and farther back still seemed condensed into a mournful gloom, brooding motionless over the biggest and the greatest town on earth.
It's here that Conrad's enigmatic character Marlowe, sitting cross-legged on deck, tells his friends about how he became captain of a small paddle steamer, embarking on the tortuous voyage up the Congo River in order to reach Mr. Kurtz. Kurtz, an ambitious agent of the Belgian company operating in the Congo, has sent back huge quantities of ivory from his ramshackle base camp in the depths of the jungle. But in so doing, he has succumbed to the brutality lurking behind the veneer of human civilization. He's become more savage than the wildest tribes of the Congo, embracing what he describes, with his dying breath, as the horror. Much has been written about Heart of Darkness since it was first published in 1899. It begs to be interpreted, but its inconclusive, ambiguous quality makes it impossible to pin down. It's hugely quoted and has been adapted into a radio drama by Orson Welles and even turned into the Vietnam film Apocalypse Now. But a lot of the attention has focused on the sections of the novella that take place in Africa and Belgium. To find out more about the framing story, the part which happens here on the Thames, I spoke to Professor Robert Hampson, a leading Conrad scholar. Tell me a little bit first about George Hope, the man who owned the Nelly. How did he and Joseph Conrad know each other?
They met in around 1880, when they would have met through the offices of a man called Sutherland. Conrad had seen an advertisement in the Times. He was looking for a ship, and he went to Sutherland's offices in Fenchurch Street. Sutherland was mainly providing work for finding posts for apprentice sailors, finding them their first post. But his offices were a place where various merchant navy people met up, hung out, and so on. And that's where Conrad met Hope originally.
They'd served on the same ship, hadn't they, but at a different time?
Yeah, they both served on the Duke of Sutherland. Conrad got a job on the Duke of Sutherland through Sutherland. No connection, except coincidence. Hope had served on that sometime before that.
So they met, and yeah. Hope is described as a sort of captain of industry who also keeps pleasure yachts, essentially, isn't he?
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
He invites Conrad to come on trips on his yacht, the Nelly.
Yes, he does. Conrad and Hope are very good friends for a long time. That Hope's background is that he had served in the Merchant Navy, but by the time they meet, that's behind him, and he's now, as Conrad calls him, a director of companies he's involved in with companies in London.
And so what kind of things do they do on the Nelly?
What happens is they're very close. They are very close. So, for example, before Conrad gets married, Conrad and his fiancée and her sister go with Hope up to Grangemouth to look at a boat that Conrad's thinking of buying. But they all go together. Hope is also a witness at the wedding. So they're very, very close. And when Conrad and his wife come back from their extended honeymoon in Brittany, they move to Essex to be in walking distance of where the Hope family is. And from there, one of the pastimes that Conrad and Hope share, one of the interests they share, is boating. So in 1891, Hope has the Nelly. He invites Conrad out for a couple of trips on the Nelly. This is in the summer of 1891. It's June and July 1891. They do two trips. They go down to Sheerness. And that's the background to Heart of Darkness.
And what about the other people who are on the Nully as well? I mean, and at the start of Heart of Darkness, Conrad talks about the lawyer, the accountant, the captain, Marlowe.
Yeah.
He doesn't talk about himself, and presumably there are five people on the yacht.
Yes, there are five people on the yacht. There's the narrator who's not named and isn't Conrad. There's Marlowe who tells the main story, who also isn't Conrad, but overlaps in terms of some experiences. And then the other three people are the three people that Conrad travelled with on the Nelly. So there's the director of companies, who is Hope. There's the accountant, who is Keane. And there's the third man, who is Mears. And Mears had also served on the Duke of Sutherland, but not in Conrad's time.
It's interesting that the lawyer gets the only cushion and the accountant is playing with the dominoes.
Yeah.
And it feels to me almost like a sort of mini satire of the sort of upper echelons of society.
Yeah.
I mean, is that how it feels to you?
Not so much a satire. It's partly that he's using the actual situation he was in, but also that they then become a kind of exemplary figures. And what they point to is a world which is not just people with a background at sea, but people whose current jobs link them into the imperial mission, as it were. They've got jobs in the City of London, they've got jobs in accountancy, law, companies, and so on. And that, in a way, anticipates things we're going to hear about in the story that Marlowe tells. So there is a connection between the world of the frame story and the story that Marlowe tells about the Congo.
Yes, I wanted to ask you about that. I mean, what is the literary significance of the framing plot, I mean, in your view?
I think where Conrad got it from was from H.G. Wells's The Time Traveller, which uses a similar device of a group of people who are in London, they're designated by their professions, and then the time traveller tells his story about this kind of fantastic experience. So there's a very similar structural pattern. And also both of them involve descents into another world. So there are lots of echoes between the H.G. Wells story and Heart of Darkness. And Conrad knew Wells well. And Wells had been a favourable reviewer of one of Conrad's first novels. So they did know each other. Conrad had read Wells' work. And what it means is there's then a question of what's the relationship between the outside world and the inside world. In the Wells story, the outside world, what we see in the fantastic story in the future is the developments in the present situation. And something similar goes on in Heart of Darkness, where there is a dialogue between that frame world of London with the company director, the accountant, and so on, and the world we find in the novel in Africa, which again has another accountant and other companies involved.
So the Nelly is a kind of almost a halfway house between the inner world of the African section of the novel and the reader.
It's very directly that, because Conrad wrote this for Blackwood's magazine, so he knew exactly, there was a readership he knew he was writing for. And in some ways, those people on board the ship stand in for the readers of Blackwood's magazine, the first readers, and then obviously they stand in for us as well. And that we are part of the problem that Marlowe has, which Conrad would have had as well, is of having an experience of a kind which it's difficult to describe to people who've not experienced that. And it's the problems anthropologists have about how do you explain this other culture to a society which doesn't know that other culture. And given that the language you have to do it in is the language of the host culture, not the culture you're trying to describe. So part of the difficulty that Marlowe has is trying to explain to these people what it's like to have had this experience that he's had, which they can't realise. And he says that at one point about how can he make this understandable to them, that they live securely with a butcher on one corner, a policeman on the other corner. So there's the policeman there to make sure that they're kept under control, there's social constraints, or the butcher supplies them with food without them having to kill for it. So he's talking about those conditions, which are the conditions of his audience on the ship, on the boat, which is also the conditions that we're living in as readers, most readers.
I mean, as an expert in Conrad, what do you think about the importance of the Nelly as a device in Heart of Darkness? Because it seems to me that so much of what is said about Heart of Darkness or written about it concerns only the African section.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Very little is actually said about what happens on board the Nelly at the mouth of the Thames.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
What do you feel about that?
No, I think you're right that the frame has been quite relatively neglected. And certainly the Nelly itself and the role of the Nelly, I think, has been neglected. That the attention is focused much more on what happens to Marlowe in Africa and also what happens to him at the end when he comes back to Brussels and sees the intended. So that even small details, like at the end of the story, they've missed the turn of the tide. Tends not to be noticed because by that point people feel they've got the kind of payoff from the story, whereas there is that small detail at the end that although Marlowe has told the story because the tide is not flowing the right way at the start of the novella, that significant change in the tide is not paid attention to. But more importantly, not much work has been done on the Nelly itself in terms of that the Nelly was the name of the boat that belonged to Hope. Hope had it for a number of years and then sold it. But what happened to it afterwards hasn't been explored.
This is Boat Radio, and you're listening to Tales of the Thames with me, Michael John. I'm exploring Joseph Conrad's novella, Heart of Darkness, and how it relates to pleasure trips Conrad took on the Thames in a small yacht owned by his friend George Hope. Some of the details of what happened during these outings in 1891 are recorded in Hope's memoir, Friend of Conrad. It was published many years after his death in 1930. Despite being depicted in Heart of Darkness as the director of companies, the Hope that emerges in his own writings is not at all haughty or grandiose. He is clearly very fond of Conrad and takes delight in preparing nice meals aboard the Nelly for the novelist and his friends.
The next day we went aboard the Nelly, taking with us a cold leg of lamb and the usual bottle of mint sauce. We always started our cruises with a leg of lamb, some bottles of Riffel's beer, and sundry small stores and our suitcases. We pulled aboard at 10 o'clock, stowed our gear, and then I proceeded to explain to Conrad how the ropes went, although he had some experience in his youth at managing a small vessel.
Hope seems to plan their itinerary based on the locations of the best pubs. For example, the Lobster Smack Inn at Hull Haven, which he describes as beautifully kept, with the beds spotlessly clean and the cooking excellent but plain. Other favoured watering holes included the Bull Inn at Chatham and the Fountain at Sheerness. In such places, the friends often bump into other seamen they know and spend time drinking with them and telling yarns, in much the same way Marlowe begins his monologue in Heart of Darkness. But the trips on the Thames are not without their moments of high drama. On one occasion, Hope describes how, during a trip up the Swale River, a powerful storm forces them to drop the anchor.
All night it blew. We found we were just opposite Faversham Creek. The tide hadn't ebbed a notch. It was kept high by the beastly wind. For the rest of the day, we played at dominoes. It was the strongest wind I'd met on this coast. When the daylight came, we were all startled by a most extraordinary and weird noise. We all three rushed onto the deck to find that the chain was rubbing on the bottom of Nelly.
The Nelly was, in Hope's view, a particularly safe yacht because she had a lead keel and was therefore less likely to capsize. She was 20 years old when Hope bought her in 1889. Writing about one of their trips, Hope says that Conrad found the yacht to be splendid. But she wasn't particularly manoeuvrable due to the fact that, in his words, she had too straight a stern. Details about the Nelly are still held at the Lloyd's Register Foundation. It's on Fenchurch Street in the heart of London's old commercial and banking district. Strangely, the shipping offices where Conrad and Hope met were in the same street. The Foundation's head of historical research is Vicky Culkin.
We look after the 256 years of Lloyd's Register's history, and we maintain the library and archive.
So here we are in this fantastic library and this building. Can you just tell me a little bit about the building?
Yeah, it was built in 1901, and it was designed by an architect called Thomas Colcutt. And his aim for this building was to create a kind of rich and interesting building, using the best craftsmen and the best materials that he could source.
So it has that amazing atmosphere. The sort of roof looks like it has beams, and we're surrounded by lots of tomes, all lined up neatly on the shelves. And across here is the Lloyd's Register of Yachts. And this is where we are going to be able to find out about the Nelly and her history. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
So just talk me through these books, if you would.
Okay, so the Yacht Register was published by Lloyd's Register from 1878. And it details yachts that were classed by Lloyd's Register and also yachts that were not classed, so the owner could have their yacht put into the register.
And just looking at it, I mean, it's a sort of olive green kind of... quite odd little books, aren't they, with these brass trims?
Yes, some of them, none of the ones that we've got out, but some of them have the original clasps still attached to them, so you have to kind of unfasten it before you can look in the register.
What was the purpose of that?
Decorative, I would imagine.
Okay. So if we just have a quick look here, just talk me through what we can see on these pages.
Okay, so... we have the ships are all listed alphabetically, so we're on the ends, obviously, to look for Nelly. And what you have in the first column is the official number of the ship, the yacht, and then you have the name of the yacht. Then you have the rig, so in the case of Nelly, she is a yawl. Then you have the tonnage, the dimensions of the yacht. Any information about the engines, obviously some would have had engines. And then you have the information about the builder and the designer, if there was one. Then you have where the yacht was built and when it was built. And then you have information about the owners and the port that she belonged to. And then if she was classed by Lloyd's Register, you would have the information about the classification.
Right. So in the case of Nelly, we can see that she was 33.5 feet long, 8 foot wide, depth of 6 foot, built by J.G. Hicks of Plymouth in 1869.
Yes.
And just moving along the table here, we've got subsequent registers, and she appears up until...
Her last entry in the register is for 1895 to 96, and she has no owner in that year. The year previously, she has an owner whose name is just Maltby, so we would assume that that was their surname, and they were based in Kent.
But Sandgate, wasn't it?
Yes,
so,
it was,
so that,
yeah.
All we know is someone called Maltby from Sandgate. And then she disappears from the yacht register, basically, doesn't she?
Yes.
The following year. What year is that? 1896?
Yes.
So what happens next?
Her entry in the Mercantile Navy List closes in 1896.
So just so that we know, that was the Lloyd's Yacht Register, which was a voluntary record, wasn't it? So people who owned yachts could choose to put them into the yacht register.
Yes.
Why would they do that? I mean, what was the advantage of putting it in the register?
There would be a certain element of prestige with having your yacht in the register book, but entirely voluntary, you didn't have to.
So this other record is not voluntary. This contains the records of all ships, doesn't it?
Yes, yeah.
And so what are we looking at now?
This is the Mercantile Navy List. So this was part of the Registrar General of Shipping and Seamen. So they would issue official numbers, and you can see Nelly's here is 95443. So she would have to appear, because she was flagged British, she would have to appear in the Mercantile Navy List.
And we can see from this document that the registry was closed in 1896.
Yes.
And what does that actually mean?
There could be a number of reasons. She may have been sold abroad and re-registered under a different flag. She may have been broken up. She may have sunk.
So basically, At this point, it's impossible to say what became of the Nelly.
Yes, I would err on the side of caution, and based on the fact that she had been sold to somebody else. She may have been sold, and Maltby may have sold her on after he had her for a year, or may have decided that he wanted to get rid of her.
A few days later, I went to the National Archives at Kew to try to discover what became of the Nelly. Deep in a vault, I found a box of ageing documents that once belonged to the Registrar General of Shipping and Seamen. Among the wrinkled and brittle certificates was a single yellowed piece of foolscap, date stamped October 1896, and marked with the Nelly's official registration number, 95443. This was the ship's certificate of closure. It revealed that the Nelly's owner had reported the vessel as broken up the previous month. There were no details of who owned her at the time, so it may have been Maltby of Sandgate, it may have not. Either way, the Nelly's days afloat had ended several years before she would be immortalised in Heart of Darkness. George Hope went on to own several more yachts, including one called La Reine, which he eventually sold to Conrad. It was an odd experience, sitting at a reading table in the National Archives, staring at the handwritten words, broken up. It felt like an anticlimax, as if the Nelly had deserved a more glamorous, romantic end, more in keeping with her role in Heart of Darkness and in Conrad's creative journey as a whole. It's important to remember that when the friends went on their Thames estuary trips in 1891, Conrad was still recovering from his own journey to the Congo, where he'd become seriously ill. So not only were these outings helping to restore his strength, they were also allowing Conrad the time and space to digest his experiences, the raw materials bubbling in his creative cauldron, not just for Heart of Darkness, but also future novels like Lord Jim, Typhoon and Nostromo. So when Marlowe starts his monologue on the deck of the Nelly, as he and his friends wait for the Thames tide to turn, it is a doubly significant moment. He's telling his Congo story, which will in itself have huge resonance, but he is also beginning to voice the first of many yarns that Conrad will write in the coming years, a body of work that will become one of the most important in English literature.
Why don't you cry, my baby? Into an ocean wave, and maybe I'll heal your emotion. For your love, I desire. Like a bird.
Looking for luxury accommodation in Mallorca, but don't want to pay high summer prices? Well, Mallorcan Tonic, the low-season luxury hotel booking website, is here to help. We can save you hundreds of euros on your hotel choice, making sure you enjoy exceptional accommodation at a fraction of the summer rates. In addition, each of our hand-picked hotels offers tempting low-season incentives, including further discounts, room upgrades and complimentary cava on arrival. Whether you choose the buzz of Palma, cool coastal views, or the magnetism of the mountains, we have a hotel to suit you. You can also book our favourite restaurants, from local eateries to Michelin stars, each offering a free glass of cava. And there's lots of helpful hints about what to do during your visit. So if you're missing your sunshine fix and want to beat the winter blues, then click on MallorcanTonic.com and let us find you your dream hotel and save you money.